it's pretty close to 9 o'clock. All right, call the meeting to order. So I guess first item is, Mr. GM, do we have any additions or reorders to the agenda?
No, sir. We do not.
Thank you. Item one is the consent calendar. We have A, the minutes, and B, financial reports. Are there any questions or comments on those? Okay, I'll entertain a motion.
Motion approved. Monta Vista.
By Monta Vista, motion.
Second.
And second by Upland. Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Item two, business item A, is the budget amendment form. And Peter, is there a presentation on this?
There is. Let me make just a couple of remarks in advance. And good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the pool. The item that's before you has been discussed at the Land Subsidence Committee, and it was discussed during the budget approval and process. And what was discussed is that the item would come to you when a scope and a cost estimate had been prepared. So Andy's here to give you a presentation on this and what's included. And before he goes, I just wanted to mention that I had the opportunity to attend a GRA conference yesterday. It was a one-day seminar on land subsidence, and it was fascinating. It was one of those rare opportunities where I got to spend the whole day just on a technical subject, and it was very enjoyable. It kind of made me feel like I was back in college. You had all the professors sitting up there giving you presentations. Very interesting. A lot of folks from USGS, extremely knowledgeable on land subsidence. They presented a lot of information on how land subsidence gets monitored and in some cases can be predicted. They describe different approaches and techniques for monitoring, and they describe the differences in the data, the spatial variation of data, and the temporal variation of data that is gathered by each approach. One of the conclusions that was clear to me is that the approach in Chino Basin of collecting INSAR data, which gives us data over the entire basin, coupled with the localized data of the extensometers, which gives you very frequent data but a limited geographic location, is a really good approach for determining land subsidence and possibly managing accordingly. So it was very interesting, and I know enough to be dangerous now on land subsidence. Now with that, let Andy give you a presentation of what will be included in the scope of this item.
Okay. I put together a few slides that you probably have seen before, but it's good to have a little bit of background to get everybody up to speed as to how we got to this point and asking for a budget amendment at this point. So I'm going to just briefly go through the history of land subsidence in the Chino Basin to get us up to today. In the 90s, as you most likely know, there was a significant amount of subsidence and ground fishing in the city of Chino. What was unknown exactly was the cause, and this was actually a hot-button controversial issue at Watermaster at this point in time, and it was occurring right at the same time that the OBMP was beginning to be developed. So it was folded into the OBMP as what we call Program Element 4, which is a program element in the OBMP which is meant to address certain issues in particular management zones. This issue was subsidence in Management Zone 1. And the objective of Program Element 4 for this particular issue was to stop the subsidence from happening again, stop the fishing from happening again. So again, we didn't know what the cause was. So there was a scoping effort to develop a plan to figure out what was the cause so that we could ultimately arrive at a management plan to manage the subsidence so it wouldn't happen again. So we went through that process and performed the technical investigation. Armed with that information, we developed what we call an adaptive management plan. So it's a living document that contains a process for updating the plan from time to time as new information becomes available. So this plan was approved by the court in 2007, and that process for updating the plan consists basically of this, that we have a land subsidence committee that's composed of you, representatives that you want to send to the committee. The committee reviews the data from the monitoring program annually and then updates the monitoring program for the next year or for future years and updates the plan from time to time. That's the process that's described in the plan. The plan has never actually been updated. It was prepared in 2007, hasn't been updated. That's what we're proposing to do here with the budget amendment. The plan also contains descriptions on how to what might trigger a change to the plan. And this is some recent NSAR data that Peter was just referring to that shows the land subsidence in Chino Basin is occurring, continues to occur, but more in the Pomona Basin or the Pomona area of the basin, and not so much down here in the Chino Basin, in the Chino area of the Chino Basin. Again, just like with Chino back in the 90s, we don't really understand why the subsidence is occurring up in the Pomona Basin. Now, Peter had a movie that he was able to download from his conference that I think what we want to do is switch from the PowerPoint and show the movie, which shows a time series from the NSAR data from the 90s to the early part of the 2000s that shows some of the subsidence that's occurring in Pomona and Ontario. Really doesn't show it so much in Chino because NSAR isn't so great in agricultural areas. So where you should be looking at is up here, and this is the Pomona and Ontario areas up in here, and we're catching a little bit of Chino down in here. So this is the Pomona area. And as we get bluer and then into the magenta color, you'll see that we're having some elastic deformation of the land surface. And then this is the Pomona area here. And again, Ontario over here. And Chino is further down here, but it's incoherent in this data set. So that's showing... that's showing the Pomona area, in particular, subsiding most over that time period of 96 to 2002.
Let's play it one more time so people can appreciate these.
Is there the ability to zoom in on that area? Or?
Not on this movie, I don't think. But here's Prado down here, and here's Chino Creek coming up. And the area of most subsidence where we had the fissuring was down in here, and this is what we call central MZ1, and then Pomona up here. This is the sixth basin, so this is the fault, the San Jose fault coming between the two. This is really what concerns us, is that we're actually seeing the ground surface come up a little bit in the six basins, but then down in the Chino Basin here in the Pomona area, and that is where we fear ground fissuring could potentially occur because of the differential subsidence.
So when I saw this, I thought this was very interesting because it's kind of the time frame that leads kind of right up to the peace agreement and the OBMP. As Andy mentioned, some of the data south is not included because they used NSAR, which is not necessarily stable in agricultural areas. But just the same, it shows the Pomona area and shows the Six Basins area. And it shows that over a period of time leading up to the OBMP. Their color scheme is interesting because blue generally for us means something positive happening or something increasing. In this case, it's the exact opposite. Blue means there's subsidence going on. And the elasticity of the ground is actually very interesting, some places up or down. But you see that area in particular is blue and just keeps getting lighter blue and then going into the magenta color. Does anybody want to see that? I had to watch it three
times.
I'd like
to see it again.
Okay, so let's play it one more time, Adam.
So blue is not good.
Yeah, watch this. Right. You see, it, black is sort of the ground staying the same, and blue means you're having subsidence. This is displacement in centimeters.
So that yellow mountain that's peaking up, that's not in our basin.
Six basins.
Right. You can kind of see the distinction between the two, right?
That's the one right there where the pink just, magenta just pops up.
Yeah.
What are the, on the blue area we're looking at, what's the easterly air portion of that? Whereabouts is that? Is that the Ontario area, or is that going on?
Yeah, this is the Ontario area here. Let's go ahead and play it again, yeah.
Maybe you can pause it.
Just pause it.
So again, Prado Basin, you can see here, this is the Santa Ana River here. These are the Jurupa Hills. So this area over here is Ontario. Pomona. You start to get down into Chino here. The elastic up and down is subsidence that doesn't really concern us too much. It's more of the persistent, gradual subsidence, permanent subsidence that is the concern.
Okay.
How do you differentiate that on this? You know, I mean, because it seems to be moving and not staying the same.
Yeah. It does move like that. Every year it'll move like that. As water levels come up and go down, you'll see the ground surface move up and down. But what the key is to monitor over longer periods of time and look for the overall trend over time. You're going to have small fluctuations seasonally, but if there's an overall downward trend, that's indicating permanent subsidence.
So if the shade of color stays about the same over an extended period of time,
then you're not really having any permanent subsidence.
Oh, no permanence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
This is dated 2002, and I mean, that was a long time ago, 12 years. Do we have an updated one that brings us through current? Because I think that Pomona's pumping, especially the Chino Basin, has changed a lot over the last decade.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this was presented by a gentleman named Tom Farr, and he works for, I believe, JPL. And INSAR data started getting collected in the early 90s, I think 92 or 93. And that's about as far back as it goes. It's continuously being collected, and it's getting processed even further with computer post-processing of the data. Tom, I think if he had a more recent video, he would have shown it. I think if we're interested in that, it's something we could probably get. Also, if we're interested in INSAR technology, there's post-processing of INSAR technology. The name for it is persistent scatterer INSAR, which will actually look for stable data within an agricultural area. Computer analysis, eliminate all the unstable areas and find stable points and might be able to give us a little more information further south. So it's just a matter of how much you want to go into getting more INSAR data. Specifically on the movie, we can look if you want. We can, you know, I would certainly be happy to call Tom and see if he has something later. I doubt it, but somebody else might.
Yeah, Andy, I had one question. I seem to recall from the recent discussions on this that in like the Pomona area, maybe we were looking at over the last 20 years, even a foot or a couple of feet of settlement, and this scale in centimeters is not nearly at that magnitude.
Right.
Am I missing something, or is it?
No, well, we were looking at 93 to the current period.
Okay.
And I'll show you a graphic that shows. This is a subset of our total time history we've been using to monitor subsidence. Can we go back to the presentation and I'll show you? A lot of these graphics I'm showing you are extracted from the annual, can you go up one? Yeah, go up one more.
You have a clicker.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, so the NSAR data that they're showing there, we've been collecting it all along as well.
Okay.
What we're looking at here is 2011 to 2013, and so this, I believe, is about 1.1516. I can't see exactly on here feet, but this is feet of subsidence over this time period. Okay. Right here. I can't tell you exactly how they process their data, and in that movie there, this is the first time I've seen it. Peter brought it back from the conference.
Okay.
But this is what our NSAR data is telling us has happened over the 2011 to 2013. Some of this subsidence that's shown on this graphic here might be that elastic. So we might have caught it on a downward trend on an elastic side, but there's definitely a permanent trend that has been occurring here over time. And we show these time history charts using the NSAR data. If I go back to this chart, this black dot right there, we have used all of our NSAR data that we've collected over time and made a time series of that right here on this chart. And the scale right here is 0 to 1.5 feet there. And the time scale is 1993 to 2014 right here. The satellites that we were using to collect this information here went down. They went out of operation for several years until we got new satellites and we picked up the time series here. So this is just a projection of the trend. We don't actually know what happened at that point during this time period, but it's a projection of this trend, and we go forward to about 1.4 feet in the Pomona area. In the Ontario area, we have a similar chart of this, and I believe it's about a foot over this same time period that the NSAR data has indicated. A trend of permanent subsidence. Again, the elastic subsidence may be superimposed on this, but the downward trend is clear.
The blue bars are recharge?
Okay, so yeah, this chart contains a lot. We try to put cause and effect on the same chart. This would be the effect, the subsidence. Yeah. But the causes are, wet water recharge in MZ1. This is pumping in MZ1. And these are water level time series at wells that are up in this Pomona area. And so the pumping and the recharge cause the water level fluctuations. The water level fluctuations ultimately are responsible for the subsidence.
So when I look at that, right, and I look at, you know, pumping's gone down, and if you look at those water level lines up there, I mean, they're kind of flat. So where is the action to that you can say justifies this continuing decline? That's why.
So, and it's a bit of a mystery to us right now. We don't have the monitoring facilities in place right now to figure out and answer that question. What we understand from our past efforts in Chino is that it can be quite complex, that the subsidence or the compaction of the aquifer system can be occurring in specific depth intervals. And so maybe deep pumping might be causing drawdown and compaction, but shallow pumping might not be causing any compaction and just a little bit of drawdown. Up in this area here, we just simply don't know enough right now. We can speculate, and we have in past State of the Basin reports and past Land Subsidence Committee reports, that potentially it might be that we've drawn down from the 1930s, where groundwater levels were a lot closer to the ground surface. We've drawn down since then. We've had some recovery, but not to back to 1930 levels. We know that this process of draining of clays and compaction of the aquifer can occur in a delayed fashion. Sometimes it takes tens, decades in order for these clays to drain and come in, into equilibrium with lower heads. So that may be happening here, but we just simply don't know enough right now. So what the Land Subsidence Committee has done is talked about this extensively over the last couple years, and in this year made a recommendation that we've seen enough of this permanent subsidence in Pomona to indicate that it's a concern and that we should do something about it as a group. And so the first step is to develop a plan on how to go about addressing it. And we have some experience on how we did it in Chino. It might not be the same exact way we did it in Chino that we do it here. So this year, the thought is to have a planning process, to develop a plan, to develop a subsidence management plan in the Pomona area. And that plan should include a scope and a schedule and cost estimates so we all know what we're getting into before we agree to it. So that's what is being proposed for this fiscal year, is to go through that planning process through the Land Subsidence Committee. Also, the MZ1 plan was prepared in 2007. It's dated. It is not an accurate reflection of what Watermaster's current efforts for subsidence monitoring is, or what our future efforts are going to be, including this Pomona issue. So the proposal here is to go through this planning effort for Pomona and then update the plan in general and have an approved plan by the end of this fiscal year and use it to help us budget for the next fiscal year and fiscal years in the future. So I think that is what I just described there is essentially what this $100,000 is for. It's to, within the Land Subsidence Committee, develop this plan. The Land Subsidence Committee is open to everyone. We have a meeting scheduled for later this month to kick off this process. The process will be probably include development of technical information as much as we can generate on the Pomona area as possible to help us develop the plan. It's going to likely include a number of meetings. There may be a technical subgroup that's broken out to help develop the Pomona plan in particular. And then obviously the updated plan is going to need to go through the Watermaster approval process, ultimately be filed with the court. It's likely to be an iterative process, probably nonlinear. We can't predict exactly how it's going to play out over this next year. The $100,000 that's part of this budget amendment is a placeholder. We think it's a safe amount of money, but it's not exactly tied to a specific scope of work. But we think that it's going to entail these steps of developing technical information and having multiple meetings at the Land Subsidence Committee to develop and update the plan. So that's what I have, unless there are questions.
So the recommendation for the pool is to recommend that the advisory committee approve this. And Joe can answer any questions you might have about the form. The form is a budget amendment form that adds the $100,000 to the budget.
Okay. Any questions for Andy or Joe?
Just real quick, the scope that's going to be developed, that's going to be through the committee process. It's not going to come through this process again, is it?
It will at the end of the day, after the committee develops a recommended scope and schedule and budget for next fiscal year, it'll come through the pool process.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Any other questions or comments?
A question for Joe. This is similar to what I've asked you previously. This amendment, it's in addition to the budget. So what impact does it have on the assessment in terms of dollars per acre foot?
It will increase the assessment by 72 cents. Basically, with the production, when we originally sat down and looked at the budget, production we estimated was around 131,000. Currently, Ms. Maurizio has got that number around 138,000. So production has increased about 5%. And if you recall, when production increases, the assessment decreases. So when we were originally looking at the assessment back when we did the budget, it was around $41.88. With the reduction in the increase in the production, now that obviously drops it. And we're now looking at, if including this $100,000, last year what was paid was $40.49. Right now, if production stays exactly where it is, you'd be looking at an assessment of $40.39.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Joe, how does that relate to, I guess, we've talked before about this. We budget contingency money on an annual basis for legal, for consulting services. So is this, are we basically just using some of that contingency, or this is not, I mean, how does that work?
No, this would be brand new funding. Okay. Basically, if you recall, when we have carryover funding, for example, if we would have had money left over from the MZ1 plan from several fiscal years ago, and we knew we were going to be using this money, we could carry it over. We don't just simply, if we have extra money left over in administration or OBMP, we don't just simply carry that over. We only carry over funds if it's specific to a project.
Okay.
So again, to answer your question, this would be brand new funds.
And in terms of contingency, we don't budget contingency for engineering.
We don't?
No.
Okay.
The budget is based on the actual work that we expect them to do.
Okay, thanks. I have just one question, but does anybody else have a question? No? Okay. I guess the question is just more about, I've recently heard a couple times Ontario mentioned as having settlement, and I keep making a mental note to offline talk to you more about that, but I hear you say it's not as big of a concern. But my question really is, does this scope of work, is it going to look at the Ontario area at all?
Yeah, I would say yes. In the committees, in the committee, we will be looking at figures like this and talking mainly about Pomona, because that's been the focus because of the differential nature of the subsidence here. But I would say that in the Ontario area here, there's quite a bit of subsidence that's occurred here, and it hasn't come to the forefront like Pomona, but the data is beginning to show that it's also an issue that's occurring in there. And if the committee wants to go in that direction to also include Ontario in this, in this additional monitoring or testing in Ontario to figure it out, then it can go in that direction.
But it's not in the proposed scope for the 100,000?
No.
Okay.
I would also predict this, that what we learn in Pomona may be applicable to Ontario and tell us something about what's going on there as well.
Okay. All right. Thanks. So if there's no other questions, I guess the motion is, or the recommendation is to approve the additional scope of work and budget. So is there a motion?
Motion by Pomona.
Motion. Thank you, Darren.
Second.
Second by Van. All right. Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Anybody opposed? No? Okay. Thank you, Andy. That was interesting. Business item number 2B is the voluntary agreement form 9, which the committees have been working on. So.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you might recall, the Ag Pool had expressed some concern about the entire voluntary agreements, how they're processed. And with that advent, we looked at our records, found our records were not complete, and we've asked every appropriator that has voluntary agreements to complete Form 9s, and that has been successful. And along the way, in talking to the Ag Pool, we realized that their needs might be better met if we were to revamp the existing form that was being used. The form had been created in the very beginning, in the early 2000s. There had been an addendum that was made in 2007. And it was a good time to take a look at that form and amend it. So your pool formulated a subcommittee that consisted of the appropriators that do have voluntary agreements. And The subcommittee was you were representing the subcommittee by Dave Crosley and Van Drew, Ryan Shaw for Ontario, and Ron Craig for Chino Hills. The subcommittee met, collected its input. Dave Crosley did the Scribner's task of compiling it and passed it all to us. We updated the form. We facilitated a meeting between your subcommittee and the subcommittee of the Ag Pool, which was Jeff Pearson and Gene Koopman. And Gene was instrumental to have in there because it was Gene that had expressed the concerns mm-hmm. primarily. Mm-hmm. We reviewed the new form, and by the time the meeting was concluded, the Ag Pool representatives were satisfied that this form will meet their needs. And, of course, this form had been developed with your subcommittee's input, so it obviously meets your needs as well. The main sticking point had been whether an appropriator would be required to go out and get a signature from the Ag Pool party on an annual basis, and the new form does away with that. The new form basically mm-hmm. says the appropriator can vouch for their mm-hmm. own meter reads. So I think that was a good gain for the pool. It was a very reasonable conclusion to get to, and I think Jeff Pearson in particular was really helpful in getting Gene Koopman very comfortable with that. I think Ron Craig was very good at massaging all the needs at that meeting and making it all happen. So what you have in front of you is a new form that would be used moving forward. The form has two parts. Part A, which is when a new agreement comes to be real. The second part is what would be turned in on an annual basis. And we recommend that you recommend the advisory committee adopt that. We expect that the other pools will also adopt it.
Mr. Chair, I have a question of our subcommittee member who met with the Ag Pool. Hey, Ron, after you met with the Ag Pool, were there any subsequent changes to the Form 9 agreements? And if so, do you
not recall? Not after our meeting, no.
We might add some footnotes to it, just to indicate the form and the date that it was created, but we wouldn't change the form from what you've seen.
I make a motion and move staff's recommendation.
Okay, there's a motion.
Chino Hills, second.
Okay, a second. Is there any other comments? Are we ready to? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Anybody opposed? Okay, thank you. So now we're on to business item 2C, which is the hydraulic control losses memo that Watermaster put together.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't have much more to add. You asked for a written report on our thoughts on hydraulic control, and those have been prepared and summarized for you there on page 76 of the package. Be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. And this was for discussion only, so if anybody would like to make comments or ask questions, now's the time.
I have a couple questions, I guess, regarding the regional board's letter dated January 23rd. In the letter itself on page 78, it talks about the regional board staff is concerned that if existing and planned desalters do not achieve the required 40,000 acre feet of extraction volume, once agricultural pumping has ceases, hydraulic control will not be maintained. It kind of implies to me that, in a way, I mean, previous to that, it was talking about what the desalters produce today, that it implies that, you know, we have achieved hydraulic control to a de minimis point currently. Their concern being, you know, how do we continue to maintain it out into the future, but it looks to me like a lot of the reduction in losses is, you know, is kind of being deferred, or we're not acting upon it. And I don't really see that this letter says you haven't gotten hydraulic control, and you wouldn't be able to reduce losses through the report when I read it. It just talks about, you know, you want to do the Chino Creek well field, but it doesn't, you know, say that you really haven't gotten hydraulic control. I mean, I guess I'm struggling a little bit with that. That technically we might be there, but there's a few commitments that haven't been achieved, and I don't know if you can speak to that.
Let me try. My understanding is that there, you need to consider hydraulic control both on the east and the west mm-hmm. side of the lower part of the basin. And on the east side, you have production. That is a production that is deemed to have achieved hydraulic control on that portion of the basin. Mm-hmm. Where you still had leaking, if you will, was on the west side of the basin. Mm-hmm. And so until the time when we have the Chino Creek well field fully operational, we won't have complete hydraulic control to de minimis levels from the Chino North. So, and what they were addressing there is that you have it on the west, on the east side right now, but we're concerned that if ag production goes away quickly, you might lose it. Mm-hmm. So tell us, how are you going to ramp up to 40,000 mm-hmm. in total? Mm-hmm. But that 40,000 also includes completing Chino Creek wellfield.
And I guess okay. the location of the wells that are going to be on the west side of the basin, maybe Curtis or you could let me know. I mean, I'm not familiar with it, where those are planned.
Well, yeah, I'm sure Curtis can add a lot more detail. They're beyond planned at this point. The wells mm-hmm. have been drilled. Two of them are operational, and I believe Curtis has a schedule for equipping wells 20 and 21. Curtis, care to comment?
Yeah, I can. Wells 20 and 21 are part of the Chino Creek well field. So those are located east of Euclid along Kemple. Those two wells have been drilled but not yet equipped, but we have awarded a contract to get those equipped, and those should be in operation by February of 2015. The additional wells further to the west, it appears that we need three additional wells to ramp up to 40,000. Two of those sites have been identified. One we have already purchased. One we, my board should approve the purchase agreement tonight for the second site. And we have bid the drilling of those two wells. Mm-hmm. And we hope to award the drilling contract at a board meeting next month. Mm-hmm. The location of the third well will most likely be along Archibald, north of kind of the county line area. That specific location is yet to be determined. We are working through a process with the plume parties on the Archibald South Plume to see if there's a joint project that can accomplish both goals. So, and we're continuing to work through that process, and I think now we hope by late fall to know where that well is going to be located.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it's certainly not west. It's really kind of in the central.
Mm-hmm. It
south.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, those would be kind of in the MZ2 mm-hmm. area.
Yeah. And if I could just try to make some clarification here, I think on your point, it sounds like in the memo on page 76, it sounds like we're talking about two different things. One is achieving hydraulic control and what's needed. The other is maintaining hydraulic control and what's needed. And I think there's a difference, but this is part of the reason the pool asked for this item to come forward. So I'll try and ask the question that I think is one of the questions. It says that the Water Master is working with the regional board to prepare a plan to demonstrate how hydraulic control will be maintained. That's dealing more with getting to the 40,000 acre feet in those three wells that Curtis mentioned right in the middle. But more pressing or sooner than that is, as Curtis just said, the Chino Creek well field, the remaining two wells, should be operational in February 2015. So what I'm understanding is February 2015 is the point where Wildermuth would agree that there's hydraulic control has been achieved and we would move forward with reducing the losses.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So one of the questions that I have is, can we start now by doing that reevaluation? I think it says we will reevaluate losses. Maybe that's already occurring.
Yeah.
and so that when we get to February 2015, we're not starting the process to reevaluate, you know, losses. I mean, can we do the analysis now so that come February, assuming the wells are operational, we could put whatever steps are in motion to adjust the water losses? I think that's the desire of the pool, is to is to not waste any time.
Yeah. We understand the desire of the pool, and at the same time, we need to manage our resources and our level of effort that we're putting into everything, and we'll do our best.
Okay.
I can't make you a promise that we will have it completely reevaluated, but what I can tell you is that even if we are delayed in getting to what the loss factor will be, it will go back to the date. And actually, Curtis and I have discussed getting sort of an official communique from the CDA saying, here's the official date when we started full production from Chino Creek Wellfield, and that will be the date that we tell the regional board we have hydraulic control. That's the date that we'll use for our tracking of storage and losses.
That seems reasonable. And so it's not necessarily going to be at a fiscal year or an annual year basis. It'll be something in the middle of the year, potentially, where we start to see that adjustment.
At the risk of stepping on Danny's toes, that's my intention. Is we should be able to prorate.
Okay.
And so we should be able to do that.
Okay. Is there any other comments or questions?
Post 2015, when we reevaluate water losses, is it at all a realistic possibility that it'll be 0%?
I don't know. It's supposed to be 1% or less, and so that zero falls in that realm, but I don't know.
Thank you.
So that is the analysis that still has to be done?
Correct.
Okay. Dave?
Thank you. The idea of proration intrigues me. I understand that the losses are applied based on balances held in storage as of June 30th of each year. Is there a detailed tracking throughout the year so we see how storage accounts go up and down? I thought it was just a June 30 to June 30 kind of a approach.
It is a June 30 to June 30 approach. So with the exception of those transactions that happen during the year and affect the balances at some points during the year, the accounting is done on an annual basis. So currently the 2% loss is done one time a year. And so I imagine, we haven't had a chance to really address this, but I imagine what would happen is at the end of the year we would say, here's your balance at the beginning of the year, balance at the end of the year. 2% losses are applied up until, say, February, and some other lower loss factors applied for the remainder.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I'm kind of projecting a little bit of the calculus that we will be going through. We haven't actually done that.
So there could be a prorated water loss percentage for
right.
that first year.
We might have two columns in that assessment package. I'm not sure yet. Or maybe one with an extra sheet in the back. I don't know yet.
So one of the other questions, Peter, that occurs to me in looking at this is related to the model and the safe yield work. And I just was curious, if we don't know what the water losses may be reduced to, how are we addressing water losses when we're doing the safe yield modeling work? I understand that we've assumed hydraulic control in the modeling for the safe yield calculation, but we would have had to assume some reduction in water losses.
The model is the model. It's the physics of the basin. The 2% that you see in the assessment package is accounting. The model doesn't care about accounting.
Okay. So then the model doesn't have that assumption on water losses going away? Or
model makes no assumption on the accounting of what's in stored water accounts.
Your stored water accounts don't affect what happens in the basin physically.
Okay.
So it's two completely separate considerations.
Okay.
If there's losses, the model models the losses, but that's not related to what is applied to your stored water accounts. Accounting,
I guess,
versus physics.
Yeah, I guess maybe I'm misunderstanding a little bit. It seems like if that's true, then wouldn't we be able to just look at what the model is doing in that run and know what the water losses are now? Or February? I mean, is there really a new analysis that has to be done? because it seems like it would already be in the modeling work that's being done for the Safefield. I mean, accounting irregardless, but the reality that the model demonstrates seems like it would already be available.
My understanding from conversations with Mark is that he does need to make a model run to look at losses when hydraulic control is achieved, specifically. And my approach with Mark has been to create it, to ask him to create a tech memo that documents what he's done. I can't answer directly your question. I don't know if his model run can does give that.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Justin?
You have Tosh?
Okay.
Well, just a quick question. My understanding of piece two says that, and also subsequent resolutions, that when the Chino Creek wellfield is complete, then we've achieved hydraulic control, and that there's a certain de minimis quality to that hydraulic control when it's achieved. Are we interpreting de minimis as 1% or less? Is that an interpretation?
De minimis for purposes of
assessing losses.
Right, but a de minimis loss or de minimis discharges from the basin. We're interpreting de minimis discharges from the basin based on what the regional board has indicated would qualify as de minimis, which is less than 1,000 acre feet of discharge.
There's a recognition in the agreements that once we achieve this certain project completion, that we will have achieved hydraulic control.
Okay. I think the definition of hydraulic control as it's used in piece two is comes out of the basin plan amendment. And so, correct, the definition that the regional board gave us earlier this year as to what would achieve de minimis discharges is what we're using to evaluate when we have hydraulic control, which is then the necessary step to get to losses of less than 1%.
And that's all tied into the analysis that using the model that will be conducted once the creek well field is in operation.
Tied in what manner?
Tied in as the controlling the analysis to a
once we pass that threshold, then the conditions will have been met to change the losses. I don't know that the de minimis discharge from the basin, as Peter said, that the model is kind of agnostic as to the accounting. So the physical reality of less than 1,000 acre feet leaving the basin will be part of what's incorporated into the model run. How it factors into the loss calculation is beyond me in terms of the actual physics.
Thank you.
Okay, Todd, did you have a question?
I had a question for Andy. There's been a graphic that you've had in presentations, or Mark's had in presentations previously, about the rising water down at Prado. Mm-hmm. Once hydraulic control is achieved and we complete all of our pumping obligations, do you have any idea whether that decreases or what impact, if any, that has on that? Only because my concern is we can document water coming in from the river, but at what point can we assure that that has a yield impact, that you've ever been able to capture it? We can count it, but is it real if it still potentially being lost and coming up as rising water down at Prado? And is that truly hydraulic control?
The model, we can tease out all the answers to the questions that you're asking right now with the model results. Mm-hmm. The model has a water budget, water flowing in and out of the basin in different areas. We can estimate water flowing past the desalter well field. So all this information is readily available to us to answer those questions and come up with a new loss rate that everyone agrees to, based on the technical information. So I can't answer your question specifically with numbers right now, but the model has water budgets that that can be teased out of the results that I'm assuming we're going to use when we get to that point.
I think what our concern is, we're looking into the safe yield discussion. When we talk about Saruni, is Saruni real yield, or is it just yield that's coming in that we can count and not being able to recognize as a firm source of quantifiable usable water? Or is it just getting lost, coming in, and then ultimately getting lost and not captured? So it seems as if even after hydraulic control, we're going to have rising water. Where does that come from?
There still will be water leaving the basin and deep into Prado Basin. There's still going to be water leaving the basin. The new yield created by desalters is not necessarily measurable by gauges, but the model can be used to estimate how much more inflow we're getting from the river and how much less rising groundwater is leaving. And that is new yield. But we use the model to estimate what that volume is.
Simplistically, I originally thought hydraulic control, kind of stopped the leaking, but it's important for me to understand, and maybe everyone, that there's always going to be some of that that's still leaving the basin.
And the model results for underflow from the river, my understanding is that it's a net water coming into the basin from the river. In other words, it accounts for what comes in from the river into the basin and also what goes from the basin back into the river.
Okay.
So that's the net.
All right. Is there any other comments or questions?
Well, I just have one more question maybe for Andy. So based upon the modeling that you've done to date and what was presented to the regional board, it looks like pumping of about 1,500 acre feet a year from the Chino Creek well field would result in the 1,000 acre feet, criteria being met. Correct.
Yes, that's what our model results indicate, mm-hmm. and that is the information we provided to the regional board, and that was the criteria they used to say that is de minimis. Mm-hmm. That'll be our definition of de minimis. The original language was eliminate flow from Chino North into Prado. That's what the desalter well field was supposed to do, but it had a de minimis or to de minimis levels, but there was no concrete number as to what de minimis meant. And that's what the letter did, was it gave some definition as to what that number is, what that de minimis number is, and the model can give you some quantification of what it will be once that Chino Creek well field is up and running and causes the necessary drawdown to get us to 1,000 acre feet or less.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think this has been really helpful, Peter. I appreciate it. I think, my takeaway is really that we're looking at sometime in early 2015, desalter, Chino Creek well field will be fully operational. You guys have some work to do, but it'll be proactive to that operational date. That'll be kind of formally communicated, and that sounds good. So thank you. Let's see, and that was just an informational item, so we'll move on to a good informational item. We'll move on to item three, which is reports and updates. Brad from legal counsel.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. A few brief reports. First, on August the 22nd, the court held a hearing on the Water Master Board's motion for an amendment to the judgment and approval of changes to the rules and regulations regarding board member compensation. You'll recall that the specific changes proposed by the board related to the ability to have compensation be paid to a board member's employer in the case that a board member is an employee of its appointing entity. There were no responsive pleadings, oppositions, anything at all filed in response to Water Master's motion. The court approved the changes requested without any comment at the hearing on August 22nd. Because there were no other filings made, the court allowed me to appear by telephone, which is nice because that results in a savings of time and money for all of us. So copies of that order were distributed through Water Master's regular email and hard copy mailing service, and also available on the FTP site as well. Second, West Venture Water Rights. Many of you are probably familiar with the fact that there was a former member of the non-ag pool known as West Venture Development. It subdivided some property that had been owned by an original member of the non-ag pool, tracing back to the judgment, Red Star Fertilizer. And shortly after the subdivision took place of the property and the well on the property was capped, there was correspondence from West Venture indicating that it wished to abandon its water rights and have them distributed among the members of the non-ag pool. Within a matter of months after that initial correspondence, there was another letter saying that that West Venture wished to ensure that in the abandonment of the water rights, that the rights of any the rights, if there are any, of the owners of the lots that were created through the subdivision property were respected, and that a court order be sought to ensure that that was the case. There has been no action since that time allocating those water rights. The non-ag pool took action out of closed session at its August meeting, requesting that Water Master allocate those rights among the members of the non-ag pool. There are other members of the Water Master community that feel that there's a different, proper disposition for those water rights. And we as legal counsel are in the process of compiling the factual background to the extent we're able to of those the actions taken in regard to the property and water rights. And we once we have completed that, we will work with the non-ag pool, other interested parties, to see if there is a consensus as to how the water rights should be allocated, and discuss a process to seek a court order ultimately as to the disposition of those rights. Finally, on August 29th, the legislature, California legislature, passed three different bills that together composed the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. Those bills are yet to be signed by the governor, but it's widely expected that they will be. The Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, I would say, is probably the most significant water legislation in the last 100 years in California. It recognizes represents a fundamental shift in the way that groundwater is managed within California, in that it requires management and management planning, whereas previous legislation and even adjudications have been voluntary to an extent. There is a summary included in your packages at page 85 that was put together by Brownstein and distributed to our clients. I can provide additional detail if you have questions. I think the most pertinent aspect of the legislation to Chino Basin is that adjudicated basins are expressly exempted from complying with the management planning requirements. And Chino Basin is listed explicitly by name in the legislation. The only obligations that Water Master would have under the legislation are reporting requirements, in that by April of 2016, there are requirements that Water Master submit to DWR copies of the basin judgment, any amendments thereto, as well as then annually begin submitting information relating to its factual information relating to groundwater pumped within the basin, total water use within the basin, groundwater storage changes, water elevations, things like that.
Okay. Any questions or comments for Brad?
Just real quick, you mentioned the process on West Venture. Now that the non-ag pool's taken action, it'll be a Water Master process where everyone will be notified as to providing documents and all that sort of thing.
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah, and I apologize, Brad. You may have said this, but I was trying to quiet my phone at the time.
I didn't notice.
Yeah. So we touched about this the other day a little bit, Peter, in the last week. But so Watermaster as an adjudicated basin is exempt from this. However, we still need to provide certain reporting information.
Exempt from the planning requirements. Okay. So there's no requirement that a sustainable groundwater management plan be developed in the Chino Basin.
Okay.
I think there's an acknowledgement that the basin adjudication has achieved the sustainability goal that the legislation seeks.
Okay.
Nonetheless, there is a requirement that for informational purposes, certain information be provided to DWR.
Mm-hmm.
The basin judgment as amended, any future amendments, and then some information related to water use, water levels, water storage.
Okay, so, yeah, so presumably if any adjudicated basin, they've all got to provide this information, it's going to be provided for review, and presumably if there was a real problem with an adjudicated basin in the eyes of whoever's going to review this, then it could become an issue? Is that...
The legislation doesn't provide any mechanism for kind of feedback from DWR to adjudicated basins.
Okay. Okay, so it's unknown at this point, I guess. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, Brad, is there a very short answer to how the groundwater legislation affects the Cadiz project? A very short answer?
Probably not.
Probably not a short answer.
Probably not a short answer.
It will not affect it.
Van, I suggest revising the question to medium-length answer.
I know there's a management plan in place for the basin from which Cadiz draws. I don't think the Cadiz basin is... So the sustainable management planning requirements apply to medium and high priority basins, as DWR will determine those through the CASGEM process. And I don't think that the basin that Cadiz is in is listed as a high or medium priority basin in the current classification. The classification has to be completed by January of next year. And then that's the official classification that will be used for evaluating whether one of these plans is required. I think there are... something like 150 different basins that fall within that the high and medium categories. I don't think the Cadiz Basin is in there, but I'm not 100% sure.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Brad. So it looks like items B and C, there are no reports, so we'll move on to item D, which is the GM report. Peter?
Thank you. Under GM report, just a note on the safe yield recalculation. I wanted to remind the pool that we have a board workshop on the safe yield recalculation next Tuesday. We haven't finalized the agenda, but I wanted to give you a preview of what we're contemplating putting in the agenda, and that is a session on a little bit of background. Why do we have to recalculate? If the board desires a refresher on some of the terms that are being used in the recalculation and a little bit of the process that we've followed so far, the information that's been exchanged, the interaction with the pools and the parties. Second area of focus will be some of the findings to date. We're going to describe for the board a little bit about the methodology that was contemplated in the peace agreement, which we've now come to call sort of a retrospective look, which is evaluate the net inflow to the basin from 2000 through 2010 and set that as the yield of the basin for the next 10 years and contrast that with the methodology that we've collaborated with the appropriate pool to develop, which is called the prospective, for sake of giving it a name, which is using the model and making some assumptions on what hydrology is going to be and how water will be traded and how water will be pumped, what then would be the water flowing into the basin over the next 10 years, and use that answer as the yield on which to base replenishment obligations on. So we'll describe that for the board a little bit, and the pros and cons of each one. As you've heard me say numerous times, going to the prospective methodology requires a correction to true up what we thought was going to happen versus what actually happened in terms of hydrology.
And it'll also require, it'll also include the new yield mechanism of when a project comes online, then the yield that that project gives becomes part of the new yield. We'll also describe for the board some of our findings for the period of 1978 to 2000 in terms of production and what was actually reported. This is a recap because it was all hashed and rehashed in the 90s leading up to the peace agreement. And also some of our findings so that the board's aware of the inflow to the basin from 2000 till today, which we believe was a little bit less than what the production rights were based on. And then we'll show the board a little bit of what does that mean, where are we in terms of water levels. So that's kind of the findings to date. The next piece of this will be talking a little bit about the future. How do we manage in the future without, you know, and staying true to what we're supposed to do, which is manage the basin for in a sustainable way. It's interesting we're talking about that language the same time as the legislature is creating the same terms. But we'll talk about some long-term objectives for the basin. And the idea is not to lead the board to make any decisions. We don't want them to make a decision at this point. We're going to be suggesting a timeline in which the board will be asked to make a decision, but we want to get their opinions and feedback, specifically with the findings to date, the reset date of when do we begin with a new recalculated safe yield, and what are the protective measures that we can go tell the court this is what we're doing to manage in the future. And then we'll open it up to the board to discuss, give us their thoughts on what they want to do, and then ask them if they need any more information than what we've provided to them. Of course, offer the opportunity for any party and the pools to give input to the board at the same time. So we'll close it up with a process and a timeline. I'm still working on it. We'll have that some dates up there of what we see as a reasonable conclusion based on where we are today for resetting the safe yield. So that's consuming quite a bit of our attention right now, is getting ready for that. We want to give the board relevant information and lead them to useful discussion among themselves. And then we have set up the series of meetings on the first and third Thursday of every month. The next one is next Thursday. And my intention is to give everybody that attends a recap of what happens at the workshop. So if you can't attend the workshop, you'll get a recap 2 days later. Mm-hmm. Now, while we were coming up to today's meeting, we had a request by, I think, Todd Corbin was interested in getting a little more information on the mechanics of how the ag pool reallocation works. And instead of just sitting with Todd, I asked him if it's all right with him if we just give the presentation to everybody at the appropriate pool. Even those that know it really well would benefit from a refresher, and those that are a little rusty on it will get quite a bit of benefit. So I've asked Danny to come up and give the same presentation. This is a presentation that you've seen before. You saw it in July of 2013. It's been updated a little bit with the numbers that we're talking about now. You might recall the retrospective methodology had a safe yield of 130. The prospective methodology has moved us to 135. So Danny has ran this number and will show you the effect of changing the developed yield to 135. And with that, take it away.
Good morning. I realize you can't really read that. Joe has handouts right now, but he's passing out. They'll be to you momentarily. I think I can go ahead and get started a little bit, though. You can read the very top. Up here in the title, this is how the ag pool reallocation works in the event of. There's various assumptions that went into this, and it will change based on those assumptions, obviously. So right now we're looking at a developed yield of 135,000. So that's what's in these. That's what's used in these calculations, and then the Saruni, the Santa Ana River underflow yield. That is what we're using right now for the assumption is 14,000 acre feet, and because we're looking at it being about 50% of desalter production, and desalter production right now is running in the 28,000s, 28 to 29. And the assumption used for these calculations is that the CBFIP stormwater new yield amount given would be 6,000 acre foot. Of course, these numbers would change if that turns out to be something different. And this is using, I say current conditions, but it's production year 12, 13 numbers. You know, we basically have 13, 14 in right now, but we're still finalizing it. We're still waiting on a few water activity reports. And until all that's finalized, I wanted to just go ahead and use the numbers that we are in the last most recently approved assessment package. So I think most of you now have the table. If you look at this upper left sort of small inset table there, again, here's a repeat of the assumption. So the change in yield basically is it's going down 5,000 from 140 to 135. But then in addition to that, like we said, this is the assumption in here is for 14,000 acre feet for Saruni, and so you know both of those are what result in the decrease in safe yield. And then in addition to that, in a year where there is an allocation given for CBFIP stormwater credit, although that doesn't technically change the safe yield number, it still has to be taken out in the same way so that it can be reallocated separately to everybody based on their operating safe yield, because the CBFIP goes based on operating safe yield. And as you know, the Saruni, when it comes out, it goes somewhere else. It goes to be used to offset desalter replenishment. So that results in a total of 25,000 that needs to be fit into the ag pool reallocation. That's the required change. That's what we call the backfill. So then when you look up here at the top right, this is a calculation that you are used to seeing in the assessment package, a very similar calculation to that. So we know the top line there, agricultural pool safe yield, it's 82,800, that's always. And their production varies from year to year, but it's usually in the neighborhood of, you know, 30,000 something. So in this particular year that we're looking at, their actual production for ag pool was 34,458. And then, like we said, the required backfill amount is 25,000. So when you take away the ag pool right, and then minus their actual production, minus the backfill, what it leaves is the total amount available for reallocation to the appropriative pool to be 23,000. It's 23,341 right here. But then we look at how much wants to be reallocated, I guess is the way to say it. So land use conversions for this particular year were 23,773 potentially amongst the appropriators. And the early transfer, the 32,800 that gets distributed amongst the appropriators, the potential, I should say, early transfer, and that gets distributed based on percent of operating safe yield. So when you add those two numbers up right here, you get 56,573. So there's a potential amount of ag pool reallocation of 56,000 approximately. You know, but as we said up here in this table, the amount available is 23,000. So what you have here, this required adjustment, the difference between those two is 33,231. Now, in the past, until we've had to deal with this decline in safe yield, and I say until we had to deal, until we've had to, you know, incorporate it into the assessment package, you know, this kind of calculation always takes place because there's always been more land use conversion and early transfer than there was ag pool water available for reallocation. It's at a larger magnitude now. So historically, that number has looked something like 3,000 to 9,000 acre feet, and now it's now it's larger, but the same type of calculation has been occurring every year. So this is how it would fit when it's time to go in the assessment package. This is how it's gonna run through there. So you've got obviously just a party name here. This is the list of appropriators, and then the share of operating safe yield. So this is the current operating safe yield. It includes the 5,000 acre feet a year for the first 40 years, and then that's just a percent. So this is the actual production number used in the assessment package, in that particular assessment package. So that's straight out of the assessment package. And this was the land use conversions that each party got that year for those that do qualify for land use conversions. And I should say that's the potential land use conversions. It's 23,773, which is what you saw up in this top table over here. And then here's each party's portion of the early transfer. And again, that's based on percent of operating safe yield for a total of 32.8. And again, you saw that number up in this top table. So when you add those two columns together, land use conversion and early transfer, you get potential for ag pool reallocation for a total of 56,000 at the bottom. And again, that's the number we went over in this top table. So potentially there's 56,000, but we know we don't have that much available. We know we only have the 23,000 available. So there's a required adjustment. And as we said, that required adjustment is 33,000. So what we do here is we take that 33,000 and change, and we prorate it up amongst each of the parties. And that's based on this number, this potential number, their percentage, any party's percentage of the total. So we prorate it based on that. We prorate the 33,000. So that then the next column is the net ag pool reallocation. So that's what they truly get. So that's the potential, but then, you know, take away for the adjustment, and then what you end up with is in this column right here. So, and then, as I said, we have to take away the CBFIP stormwater yield up here so that we can give it out here based on percent of operating safe yield. So this is how it goes in based on each party's percent of operating safe yield. That's straightforward. And then the last column here is just adding it up. This last column doesn't include everything that the assessment package has, because the assessment package has things like water transfers and carryover. But that varies too much from year to year to really put in this table. It doesn't really make sense to put it in here. But this is kind of like the basic rights. And this is just an illustration of how everything would flow through. Are there any questions?
Quick question on the 14,000. That's based on the CDA production for that year?
Yeah, well, so, you know,
or,
so
or is
far.
That perspective, if it goes up to 30, does that, or 40, does that change? And so every year we're going to have a different.
I don't know if we've decided if it's every year. I'm not sure if we've decided that yet, but we've said so far that it's 50%. And if you look at the last several years of DeSalta production, and, you know, until they get up to the 40,000 right now, for many years it's been in the 28 to 29. So this is, I mean, right now this is just for illustration purposes. You know, these are the assumptions that are used. This is more just to show you how everything works, how it flows through. The numbers can easily change in here and show you 10 different Cerunis and, you know, different assumptions. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think the Ceruni would change, especially near term with wells coming on and stuff. It's not going to be static for a while. I would think it would be changing. Yeah. Did you have a comment, Peter?
I agree with what you said. Okay. Mark Wildermuth has actually consistently predicted that it would be about 50%, and all the modeling runs he's made over the years have come back with that same answer, and the more recent ones support that as well. Excuse me. As Danny said, we're not, you know, moving forward, we'll have to come to some understanding, and right now what you see here is the reflected is the understanding that it would be 50% of the production for that year, and for that year production was about 28,000, so Danny used 14.
Okay.
So we hope that answers, Todd, kind of your concern. We really appreciate you bringing it up. I think it's a great question, great time to have the refresher, and I don't know if there are any questions.
I do have a couple comments, but it doesn't look like anybody else does. You know, I just, so everybody knows, Ontario's has some concerns with what's, you know, presented here in terms of whether or not it's really consistent with the agreements. I'm not going to try to, you know, debate that here. I've had a chance to talk with Peter and Brad multiple times over the last couple months. So, but I do want to ask a clarifying question. My understanding from the first workshop and more recent discussions is that the 6,000 acre foot CBFIP stormwater piece, it's shown here as being included in the methodology for backfill. My understanding from those prior workshops was that it was the opinion of Watermaster that approach was not very, It was a proposed approach, I think, was how it was presented initially, and in that it wasn't real clear in the agreement how that should be handled. So my only clarifying question right now is that still the viewpoint of Watermaster, that that's a proposed approach for the 6,000, and therefore you're waiting for input back from the pool?
Or? Yes, I don't think that's changed.
Okay.
We asked at the first workshop back in July of last year for any for input. Ontario, I think, is the one party we've heard.
Mm-hmm.
Most clearly heard from.
Right. Okay. I just wanted to get that clarification. And this is something that we may have a chance in closed session to discuss in a little more detail, so I'll leave my comments at that. Yes?
It says 140 is developed yield. Are you
talking about right here?
Yeah.
Maybe you just can't read it on the projection. What it says equals 140,000 minus the new developed yield. And so if we're looking at a new developed yield of 135, that's why it says 5,000 right here. So 5,000, and it says equals 140 minus.
Okay, so the 140, yeah, the question. I just was just curious. The 140, that doesn't include the additional 5,000 acre feet that's called out in the peace agreement.
Right.
Are you the additional 5,000 for the first 40 years that's from the judgment? No, it does not include that. Okay. That's sort of separate.
Okay.
That's how they do
the numbers. As Cerruti goes up and down, does that change Mark Goldman's 135,000 number? I mean, I thought it would like add to it if more water was brought in. So like I just thought that the new safe yield number or acre yield number, whatever we're calling the yield now, but that 135,000 acre feet, if we captured 20,000 of Cerruti, then would that 135 go up by that amount also, or are we just increasing the adjustment more? I'm just curious.
The modeling results using the prospective methodology is that the developed yield would be 135,000 acre feet a year for the next 10 years, for the period of time that we use. During that mm-hmm. time, Cerruti will fluctuate as part of that 135.
That's a little different than how we use it now, because now the 140 is a constant number,
right?
And then the Cerruti goes up and down annually.
Correct.
And then the stormwater goes up and down annually. So now if we're locking in at the 135, so if we have a great year and capture a lot of water, instead of if we say, oh, we've captured 20,000 acre feet of stormwater, then that basically reduces the safe yield allocation to the market?
Well, that's why, I've insisted on pointing out that if we use a prospective methodology, we need to have corrections. And whether the correction actually changes anything on any one year or whether it's accumulated to the end of a period is another story. But we have the ability to correct if hydrology was radically different than what was assumed. We assumed average hydrology for the next 10 years. And if projects come online that create new yield, that gets picked up as well. So, if there are no other questions for Danny,
Todd has a question.
The desalter replenishment obligation, which is really what started me looking into it, what fiscal year do we project that to go into effect?
This fiscal year.
The
14-15?
14-15 and 15 for the assessment.
We're right on the border. And what we've thought and mentioned to the board that we would do is we would not. If there is replenishment obligation this year, we're not going to assess for that. We're going to put that over for a year and capture it in the next assessment package until we clarify, because obviously the reset of the developed yield will affect what's in everybody's stored water account and desalter replenishment account. Mm-hmm. So we're putting that question off for a year. But we're right on the bubble.
So in addition to this, all of us have some sort of desalter replenishment obligation.
Possibly.
For the net amount of production.
Right.
So 14 to 20,000 acre feet.
Right.
Yeah, so I guess one of the questions that's being raised in my mind is, so we may this year, it sounds like, have some desalter replenishment obligation. Would that be covered by Saruni potentially, or is that going to be have to be?
It depends on when the yield gets reset.
Yeah. Okay.
And so that's why it's kind of a, you know, we need to lay out all this information and picking the reset date and keep in mind that when you change methodology from a retrospective that uses what actually happened in the basin to a prospective methodology that says from here on this is how we're going to manage, you're disregarding what happened in the past. So mm-hmm. if there was an overproduction above and beyond what the basin had to give, mm-hmm. We're running a deficit against the mm-hmm. basin. So one of the questions is, do we want to award ourselves Saruni credit when in fact we know that in years prior we ran a deficit in the basin? And it all mm-hmm. ties in with a question of when do you want to start with the mm-hmm. new developed yield?
Mm-hmm.
It's all tied together.
Okay. So I going back to the first part before Danny started, and what you just said, you laid out nicely the agenda for the workshop, which is helpful. I have a couple of questions. One of them is my understanding, you know, in the board there's been questions about just what you said. This, I think now it's called unexpected decline or whatever it's being called now. And my understanding is that you guys are working on trying to clarify how that got there, you know, given the fact that we've really had a developed yield of around 141,000 acre feet since 78 to present. So where did this unexpected, is that going to be on the agenda?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we need the board to be informed.
Right.
So when they make a decision, they make it in full awareness of everything that we know.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned that input individuals or the pool as a whole or any pool can have a chance to address the board. What input would be helpful for you to get from this pool prior to that meeting?
You know, prior to the meeting, you know, it's Thursday, right?
Yeah.
The meeting is Tuesday, and it's 8:30 on Tuesday, right. So we really don't have a lot of time.
You're still working on the agenda, though. Yeah, so
that's true. But we're looking at answering, you know, are getting the board to express their views on the key things that we're going to have to tell the court. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go back to why is Water Master here, Water Master exists because of the judgment, and the judgment was set up so that the basin wouldn't be overpumped.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we've come to the conclusion that there was overproduction, and we've identified two distinct periods, 1978 to 2000 when the peace agreement came in, and then mm-hmm. 2000 to today,
mm-hmm.
For different reasons at those different times. And we're not judging that as good or bad. That's not our place to judge it as good or bad. We're just simply saying it's something that happened. So one of the questions for the board is, please be aware of it, and what, if anything, do you think should be done?
Mm-hmm.
So we're interested in hearing from the pool just the same. So if you have input, we're going to tee it up for the board. I'm going to ask the board, tell us what do you think we should do, and what should we tell the judge? The second one is, we're going to try to explain to the board what are the different methodologies, the one that's in the peace agreement and one that, with the collaboration of the appropriative pool, we've developed the prospective methodology. How do they each work and help them understand the consequences of each one of them?
Mm-hmm.
And then ask for their opinion, are you comfortable with this prospective methodology? And if so, when do you think it should go into effect?
Mm-hmm.
And it has consequences when it goes into effect.
Yep.
And also, if you put it into effect on one particular date, then when do we do the next reset?
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the inherent questions is that what do you want to do with overproduction from the past? Also, what do you want to do with credits from the past, like Saruni credits from the past?
Mm-hmm.
And so we're interested in hearing.
Okay.
Board's thoughts on that, because we'd like to know. And at the end of the day, I believe that the board would like staff to put together a proposal that the board would eventually adopt. Mm-hmm. And as you know, if you heard me say this before, I would love to have a proposal to the board that has the agreement of all three pools.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And have it something that if the board approves it and it goes to the judge, it goes with everyone's
okay.
support.
Okay.
That's the ultimate objective.
And we do expect that one of the questions that is reasonable to expect the judge to ask is, if you've had overproduction in the past, good or bad, call it what you will, intentional or unintentional, expected, authorized, whatever you want to call it, what are you going to do in the future to prevent that from happening again?
Right.
And so we're going to lay out to the board what we believe are existing protective measures, how we're going to be suggesting that those stay in effect and become a little more highlighted, and get the board to give us some feedback on that. And we'd love to get input from all the parties in the pools on that as well.
Okay, good.
Peter, one question. What's the assumption in the model about the desalter replenishment obligation? Is it wet water recharge, or is it water and storage until which time there's no storage left?
The latter.
The latter.
It's the efficient market assumption. Okay. Yeah.
Even for desalter replenishment.
Right.
And for overproduct and agency overproduction.
Right. Mark, you had a question?
I was listening to what Peter is going to be presenting to the board workshop next Tuesday. As a board member, you know, I appreciate that you're interested in my opinion. I would say that what I as a board member would be interested in what do our contracts say about this particular issue, so that we make sure that when we start talking about opinions, they're couched with what our contracts all require us to do. So, I know you understand that, but I kept hearing, we're going to ask the board's opinion, and this is really not an opinion-based, policy-based body, or contractual-based body. So, it would be helpful in the workshop to provide the contractual basis for any questions that we have to take. So, you know, to provide an opinion that runs into inconsistencies with our contracts. But just one board member's opinion in advance.
Is that a vote for the retrospective calculation of developed yield? I'm just kidding. Of course, yeah, and that's the whole point of contrasting the methodologies. I mean, clearly the prospective methodology is not what was contemplated in the peace agreement. And so we need the board to understand that. And if that's what the board is ultimately going to adopt, which we believe would carry the support of the appropriative pool, we need the board to understand how it came about and how it's different from peace. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I would just say, Peter, I appreciate the explanation, because I think I'm hearing, you know, even some new ideas I hadn't thought of, but a lot of different things like, when will the Cerruni credit kick in? Is it going to change every year? Are we going to set a midpoint? And I know you work some with Marty and John to come up with, I think, some of the ideas I just heard right now. And that's really been helpful in our closed session discussions to try and talk through some of these issues. But I think it's going to be iterative. It's going to be some back and forth. Right. In terms of, as we kind of narrow in on a greater understanding of what we're really going to be, submitting to the court. So I think I appreciate that. I guess, you're not privy to some of the things we're talking about. So that's in closed session. So I was wondering if, and that helps to kind of lay out the kind of input you'd like to get back. And maybe we can get back to you prior to Tuesday with some of that.
And don't look, again, I want to emphasize, Tuesday is not a decision day.
Okay.
Tuesday is an idea exchange, is making the board aware, as Mark suggested, of, you know, here's where we are, here's the considerations. Mm-hmm. We have a process to go. My vision for the process in the future includes our meetings on first and third Thursdays, which should be fertile ground for that iterative process. Okay. You also have pool meetings along the way, and we have advisory meetings, and we can always call for
specials. Yep. Okay.
So that concludes my report on safe yield recalculation.
Okay. I think you had a couple others on here.
Very briefly. Recharge Master Plan Update Amendment. Wanted to just make you aware that the City of Fontana has notified us that the Sierra Basin Project, which was considered in the RMPU, is not something that they're supportive of at this point. The project wasn't huge by any means, but it was part of the slate of projects. They believe that their land use for that area will change, and they don't see the value in spending money and expecting recharge. I mentioned that at the steering committee meeting this morning. We had our quarterly meeting. We will be preparing a written report with all the updates that were given today. We'll have that ready for you by the advisory committee, so you'll find that probably at the back table next week, so you can stay current even if you didn't have the opportunity to attend. Third item on my report is dry year yield contract amendment. I think that's running through the process for most appropriators, and it's been approved by IUA. We're going to bring it to you next month for approval. And last but not least in my report is the new yield cost benefit allocation. We've talked a little bit about this off and on. This did come up as part of the RMPU amendment process. I have had some preliminary discussions with Marty and Fontana Water Company expressed an interest a couple of months ago. We're developing a concept that will probably come to you next month, and the concept would have the option of buying and selling share of cost and benefit from the RMPU amendment projects, if anybody's interested in that. Also, the new yield from MS4 enhancement opportunities, and also providing incentives to non-parties. And the concept would have these three components. I will work with Marty. We'll develop a draft, bring it to your pool for your thoughts and discussion and input.
Okay.
I think Marty was ready to talk about it today, but he couldn't be here. So
yeah.
I don't want to color it in any way that would be different. So that concludes my report.
All right. Thank you, Peter. Any other comments or questions for Peter? All right. Item number four is informational items, cash disbursements, et cetera. Any discussion? Okay. Item five, pool member comments. Are there any comments from the pool? Okay. Item six, I guess is there any other business?
Not from staff.
Okay. All righty, we're moving fast here. So this is a record for me, so I'm really happy about this. Let's go on to item seven, confidential session, and we'll take a quick 5-minute break. Okay, are we back in? All right, we're coming out of closed session, and there is no reportable action. Okay. And with that, the meeting's adjourned.
We're actually-